And once again, the sound of the Swing Thoughts theme plays as golf spiritual leader and Coach Tim welcome you back to another episode of this program. Very excited today because the book that we've been talking about literally for seems like years, but really has only been this season. Getting Unstuck is finally available. And Coach Tim, it was kind of cool seeing it in book form. Like, you held it up at our pre-show meeting, and I was like, aw. And it's very exciting, and we'll talk about that today and where you can finally get it. And as always, this program is brought to you by TaylorMade Golf, Oscar Bravo, who is OscarBravo.com, and SecretLinks.golf. All right. Let me just finish sneezing. How are you today, sir?
I'm doing all right. I'm doing a little correction. The book, I have the proof copy in my hands, and I'm showing it to you and my guest there. But I haven't pressed go just yet.
Oh, I
so
see.
There's just a few little portals it has to pass through, but any day now. Okay. So I'm just pleased about that it's no longer going to be referred to by yourself as Project 2025.
That's right. Project 2025, the Tim O'Connor book. Okay, well, let's get right to our guest today. It's a pleasure to welcome to our program the founder and head coach of Zone Golf Academy in Vancouver. She is has been a professional golfer for a very long time, LPGA. In fact, she's an LPGA life member with over 35 years of professional golfer experience and is one of the top LPGA coaches worldwide. And we're thrilled to have TJ Attlee finally on our program. I say finally because, everyone heard a couple weeks ago, we thought we were supposed to have you on, and then we kind of screwed that up, but it's great to finally meet you, and welcome.
Yeah, it's great to be on. I'm very happy to be on. Thank you.
Yeah, it's good to see you again, TJ. It's been, I was out your way, gosh, I forget when that was. That was
I think it was November 2018.
Yeah, well, that was part of the work that you do. You're preparing a lot of your junior clients for looking at the possibility of playing golf in the U.S. or in Canada. But that's a big part of what you do, isn't it?
It's a big part of what I do, yeah. So I moved back to Canada 35 years ago, and then my first kid went to school in the U.S. 34 years ago.
So is that different?
Oh, there, yeah.
That type of coaching you do, and we can talk about how amateurs do and don't learn the game. But is that a very different type of coaching when you identify a young prospect and helping them get to a school and then possibly a professional career?
I think so. So I've just placed my 13th kid at Ivy League, which is pretty cool. So I find that a lot of the smart kids end up coming to me, I would say, since about 2012, because they know I have a connection with a lot of universities. Mm-hmm. And I think the other thing that I do is I get up at 5 every day so that I connect with all the coaches on the East Coast. So a lot of times I'll fly out and we'll do a university tour. So I'll take 6 kids and we'll go to 5 states and I'll have all the coaches lined up. And so that was pre-pandemic though.
Yeah. I mean, to underscore, you've got amazing connections and so much experience. And like I was saying earlier, what connected you and I is that at the time that I went out there to be part of kind of a weekend workshop, I was the coach of the University of Guelph men's and women's golf team. And what's really interesting is that I had some players who, you know, they were plus handicaps men, and they were looking at careers as professionals. But I always thought that's a tough road. So what I wanted to ask you was, what are the sort of the markers that would give an indication that a junior golfer perhaps has a shot at perhaps getting a scholarship at a Division I or even a shot at becoming a professional?
Yeah, that's very hard. And, you know, I tried for 4 years trying to get on the circuit. So that was like in the 80s. And so I know it's a very hard road. So I think it takes a very disciplined player to be able to get onto the Pro Tour. Like their parents have to be totally on board.
Okay, but what kind of scores, what kind of tournament schedule do kids as young as, say, 15 and 16, what kind of golf do they need to be playing to even be dreaming about possibly turning professional?
Yeah, I would say the boys have to be shooting between 65 and 72.
Wow. Like 65, like just falling out of bed, and they do it like it's not something exceptional. It's just that they can shoot these scores.
Yeah.
And not too.
It takes a you know, obviously you guys know, it takes a very strong mental game to, you know, one week you're great and the next week you're missing the cut. So.
And not to dwell on the professional side of what you do, because as you've mentioned, you know, you've been placing young people in pretty amazing circumstances for a long time, and you've been coaching them, and we all know, we've been around professional golfers at a pretty young age. It's like a young hockey player. You can have all the talent in the world and still not make it.
Yeah.
And as you were saying, Tim, you know, that professional golf road is a tough one. And so taking young people that can play and getting them Ivy League scholarships, a pretty nice way to use your golf as an entree into the real world.
Well, that's it. So they, with the kids, they obviously have to be smart. They're going to be using golf as their sport, but then, I'm also pretty involved with, I'm involved probably from grade six on regarding their academics, like all of their academics and what AP classes they're taking. And I've been involved with SAT for 19 years. So they will start training their SAT. They'll write their first SAT in grade eight. So I'm pretty on top of it that way.
Wow. Isn't that a little young? I don't think I could spell SAT in grade eight.
Yeah, no, these kids are smart. But then they also have to do something else. So they have to have a third piece. And the third piece is either debate, model UN, science fair, or they have to own their own company. So I've had kids starting at grade six that we've talked to their families and they started their own company.
And they're doing what? They're selling real estate or lemonade at the end of the driveway?
They can do anything, but sometimes they'll have a charity or sometimes they'll do a ton of volunteer work. Like I had a kid who did 10,000 hours at the Vancouver Aquarium.
So it's not just golf that you concentrate on. The Academy, Zone Golf Academy, is more than just, you know, how to get better at your short game. But let's talk a little bit. And I also want to touch on at some point the fact that you've played in major championships and what the amateurs listening can learn from, you know, that kind of experience. But let's talk a little bit about the coaching of an actual golfer. And I know that you've been instructing young people for a long time. But what about when, from a professional's standpoint, about what do most amateurs miss when it comes to improving their golf games that you've seen time and time again?
Okay, so a couple things. So number one is their basic fundamentals have to be pretty darn solid.
Mm-hmm.
So, and having I've spent the last 2 years building my curriculum on how to go from new to play to shooting 90. So that's kind of fun. Tim kind of knows that, but I've kind of finished that. So it's like 150 videos and I think over 800 pages and then 40 different stat pages. So it's a very logical, holistic approach on getting somebody who's maybe an adult who wants to play a decent game and not be, you know, embarrassed.
But TJ, if I can just interject, because I really, really love what you said about working, about fundamentals, because I think for the average player listening, we're always looking for something, but yet the basics of the golf swing are, first of all, they're boring, stance, grip, alignment, setup. But it's funny when you think about how many good players, they all have those good fundamentals. And is that one of the things that's missing in amateur golfers?
100%. So I took the 8 Ivy League coaches, Northwestern and Duke, to China in 2017. And so the 8 guy Ivy League coaches, I knew them all. But I didn't know Pat Goss of Northwestern. I knew who he was, obviously. He teaches Luke Donald forever. And then I didn't know Jamie Green that well. I had met him once at the Kerry Cup in Ireland. So I got those two guys upstairs at a driving range in China, and I go, what's the number one thing that you guys see with your players that come in that you recruit that they're missing? And they both agreed on the same thing. They said, at address, our players don't have a tilt.
Wow.
So that was funny. So it was something with the address position. So something super basic.
Yeah.
And both of them agreed 100% that that was the number one thing that they were missing.
And just to follow up quickly, Tim, like TJ, and I, because I've been thinking a lot about this lately, about how those parts of the game, I call them the non-negotiable fundamentals, are the things that a lot of, I'll tell you, male golfers, I see it all the time, don't want to bother with because it's not as exciting as some tip you saw on Instagram or YouTube. When you forget that working, if your grip and alignment and your ball position isn't right, none of it's going to work.
I agree. Tim, what do you think?
Oh, absolutely. But the thing I wanted to just get a lot of our listeners, I'm trying to bring some an image to this. When you say the tilt, so for a right-hander, would it be almost like looking at, I don't know, a letter K and seeing that the left shoulder is higher than the right? Is that kind of,
yeah,
kind of what you mean?
Yeah.
Okay,
yeah.
Cool.
So I like to teach that the right shoulder and the right knee and right foot line up together in one line.
Yeah.
Spine's on an angle, and it's because the right hand's lower than the left if I'm a right-handed golfer.
Yeah, well, I imagine that would be really helpful to a lot of our players because, as we say, we talk about the fundamentals, but sometimes people just don't quite grasp what it is. So I think that could be really helpful. What I wanted to explore with you, TJ, is you already mentioned parents. And so parents can be absolutely wonderful and great, but there's also a lot of parents who are actually rather toxic with their kids. And so let's start with the good stuff first. So I think this would be interesting to a lot of our listeners who are in a demographic where they're parents and they may have kids who they'd love to get into golf, or the kids are already into it and they'd like to help further them along that road. So what are the key things that parents can do to positively influence their kids in golf?
Well, one of the words is positive. So they got to be, if they're taking them to practice, they have to be words of positivity for sure. See it all the time, you know, the hockey parent or the, you know,
yeah.
To me, it's a bad golf parent who is super, you know, gets very mad at the kid or frustrated at the kid, which is like silly. They should find a coach. And so the reason I say that is because so I grew up, there's five kids in our family. So I'm kid four. I started playing golf at age 12. And then my dad, and I had a little brother. I have a little brother. And so like he was five. And my dad said, you have two options. You either do chores all summer and help your mother look after your five-year-old brother, or I drop you and your brother off at the golf course at 4 to 6 in the morning. And then you take the 8:47 bus home.
Wow.
So that was a no-brainer. And he goes, I don't care if it's pouring rain, if it's snowing, whatever. He goes, so I did that every day in the summer for 3 full years. But the problem is that's 15 hours a day practice or playing at a public golf course. But I had no coaching other than my dad, and my dad shot 100.
Mm.
So it was like when I finally got a lesson, which was grade 11, it was, I ended up, you know, the coach said, okay, we're starting from the beginning. Because I shot 90 and had a huge slice.
Well, what do you say to those parents, particularly dads, who consider themselves pretty good golfers, even though they might be, not to be disparaging, a 15 handicap or even a 7, and they think they know golf and they can teach their kid? What do you say to that parent?
Yeah, I say to that parent is you need to hand them over. Like you need to bite the bullet, even if it's group class. Need to hand them over because, I mean, would you be on the soccer pitch with the coach if the kid was in soccer?
Mm-hmm.
You know, playing silver soccer, would you lace up your skates and try to be on the ice when the coach is having practice? So I always think that golf is a precision sport. We already know that, right? 64 sports in Canada, there's two precision sports. That's it. So I think you need a trained professional to help your kid along, even if they're playing recreationally and just want to go for fun.
And what do you say to parents? I was with a friend of mine who works with young golfers as well. He's a mental coach recently, and he was telling me, I was talking about his clients, and, you know, he was saying some of these parents sort of drop off their kids with him, and you can sort of tell early that the kids aren't really committed to it. They're sort of into it because their parents want them to be. And you mentioned the hockey parent. What's the golf parent like in that situation?
The golf parent when they just drop off the kid
where the parents, yeah, the kid doesn't really want to be there. I'm sure after your experience, you identify that pretty early on.
Yes, for sure. Yeah, so we have to make golf class fun. Which is why I made the board games. Because it just has to be.
Talk a little bit about the board games, if you will.
So it first started with the first of all with the children's books. So the first children's book was like 10 years ago when Nixon was born. It's my grandson, and so then I've written 3 books total. They're in 4 to 6 languages, and then a couple years ago I said, okay. Like, there has to be, okay, I'll give you for instance. So I've been teaching golf since the freshman year in University of Washington. And so 2008, I write my first official rules test from BC Golf. Okay, so I go to weekend class, and only myself and another girl pro were in class, and there was about 20 amateurs. And I go to write the test, and the test is so hard. Even level 2 at this point. And so I get 79%. Passes 80. Mm. And I'm just like, oh my God, how can I have been teaching golf for 24 years? I know the rules. This is crazy. So then I went to bed every single night for a year reading the rules book. And I'm just like, I'm freaking going to ace this test in 2009. I go back to BC Golf. I do the two-day weekend thing in March. I write my tests again. I get 79%.
Come on.
I'm like, no. Wow. How is this possible? And by this time, I had an SAT company. So, and my daughter was watching Jeopardy every night. So Jeopardy, every time they write a question, Alex Trebek would write the question, and he had 13 writers after him had to read the question, had to tweak the question, and if the question was good, it went on the air. So he had 13 checkpoints after him. And then with SAT, it's the same thing, right? Like, it's the same thing. Like, there's one answer. So there can't be, like, two answers. So in any case, long story short, I wrote a letter to Golf Canada. I was not very happy. And I said, if I can't pass the rules, how can anybody else pass the rules? So then fast forward to years later, I'm just like, okay, there has to be a better way, which is how I came up with the board.
Ah, I see. Well,
Let me interject. Go ahead. What was the response of Golf Canada?
Yeah,
what
did they say?
Oh, yeah. You know what? Oh, my God. Okay. So I wrote 2 people. So I wrote the 2 people that I could find on the website. He literally on Monday morning. So he got my package. The president called me and he said, I'm sorry that you had this bad situation, because it was a 6-page type letter. And it was 3 questions on each 2008 and 2009 on why their question was written wrong.
So the questions were too ambiguous.
Yeah. So what happens, though, I know the longest tee you can play is 4 inches. But the way that they wrote the question is they used a double negative.
Right.
And then they had a false or true answer. So I'm just like, anybody who's ESL writing this test is not going to pass.
There you go.
So did you ever pass the test, I think, is what we need to know.
I did, yes.
That's
so
right.
I've written the test.
That's what I'm talking about.
I've taken the test, I want to say, 6 times, and I've passed it twice.
TJ, let's talk about the idea of playing games. And yeah. why adults, because we have adults, well, semi-adults in our case. We have some immature people listening to our program. Trust me, if you've ever heard it, it's very immature.
And we, of course,
we model that perfectly. Yeah, exactly. We model that behavior. But one of the things that, you know, I think a lot of men and women miss as adults, they miss that this is all supposed to be fun. Yeah. And that learning it is supposed to be fun. And the game itself, you know, one of our friends, Kent Osborne, always talks about, we're just pay-to-play players. I mean, yeah, I play a lot of tournament golf, but I'm not a, no one's paying me to do this. You know, we're lucky that TaylorMade gives us some equipment, but, you know, we're so, all supposed to be enjoying this experience when we go to the golf course. What in your experience, can make learning the game funner for grown people?
Okay, so last year I caddied 175 rounds, and many of them, half of them were my adults. So, and then a lot of times when a coach goes out and plays, I don't want to say the guy coach, but the guy coach has got a big staff bag on the cart, and then he puts, you know, the ladies' clubs on the back of the cart, and then he's hitting the ball like 290 yards, and she's hitting it like 100. And that's pretty intimidating on its own. So for me, I walk and push their cart. So for me, that's a lot of the fun part of it is being the experience out there with them.
Yeah, that's my experience as well. I haven't done many playing lessons in the last couple of years, but when I was doing them, that seemed to be more of a pre-COVID thing. I think when there was more time, it always seemed to me the best thing to do was just to walk along with the player, talk about the shots, all about, and just make it all about them. I just find that that's the thing. And really, I think that's where the most effective coaching happens, is on the golf course. Because people, why do you think that coaching on the golf course is more valuable than, say, just being on a range or hitting off into a screen or something?
Right. So I was told that golf is the only sport in the world where we practice where we don't play. So the mat's a perfect lie. You get a new to play player, and you try to explain to them, you know, okay, this is what the fairway is and this is the rough and blah, 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 blah. But then when they experience it and they go, oh my God, like the ball's in the rough, but it's like it's the first cut, and they go, how am I supposed to hit this? You know what I mean? Like, they're just like, oh my God, nobody told me the grass was this long.
Yeah.
Or the ball's below my feet.
Yes.
Yeah, the lie's different. You know, and that's why it really is the lie of the driving range is that it's such a false positive. But
well, it is. It's false positive. Yeah. And then these kids with, Tim was in my studio. I, you know, did have technology. I've had four different indoor studios. So I had the first indoor studio in Canada in 1990.
Wow.
Yeah, back in the day. I do have technology, but I find these kids are addicted, you know, just like they're addicted to, you know, their phones and games and everything. A lot of times they're addicted to numbers.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Well, So
I'll do this. I'll take out the kid. Mm-hmm. Who's good, and I'll say, okay, we're playing 18 holes, and you're only allowed to take four clubs.
Right.
You know? What? I go, yeah, you know, you need to learn how to manufacture a shot.
So getting back to my question.
I was going to say my first week at University of Washington. So, of course, I'm the freshman, so there's 12 girls on the team, and six of us are freshmen. And, of course, the older classmen are going, okay, which stupid freshman is going to make the dumb comment first? Okay, so it was the Canadian. It was me. So it's like, okay, how far does your pitching wedge go? I go, exactly 100. Well, between 100 and 102. Okay, I want you to hit the 100-yard sign. And then it was just like, okay, we had everything back in the day to 3-iron, right? Because it's 1980.
Yeah.
So then it was just like, okay, I want you to hit, you know, now you're going to hit your 5-iron to 100. Like, I had to hit every club to 100 yards. I had to hit 10 balls every club to 100 yards. So finally, you know, before that, it was even before we even got to the 5-iron. I'm just like, hand up. Yes, yes. And then why are we hitting my 7-iron goes 100 to 132. Why is my... And then so they go, yay. And they're like putting dollars down like it was a Canadian that had that stupid question. And then Dean Eilenfeld, my coach, said, she goes, no, like one day you're going to have to hit
Right.
One day you're going to have to hit your 300 yards. So then, as it turns out, it ended up being the LPGA qualifying schools under a tree. I hit it at 4 iron exactly 100 yards, and I put it like a foot away from the hole.
Nice.
And then the other was like, how did you do that? And I go, trust me, we had to practice it all the time.
That's right.
Yeah. But I think the kids don't do that. They stand there and make this one swing on the range.
Well, like you said, they get addicted to, they become very techno-wise. And, you know, at the course I play at, there's guys, kids in the coaching area with their with kids who own their own TrackMan, talking about their VSPs and their angles of attack. And they're, and as you say, they're hitting the same shot over and over again. But back to my question about amateur men and women who are going to go to the golf course this weekend. If they can't get you to caddy for them, how do you think, what do you suppose they should do to make their learning experience more fun?
Okay. When they go to the range, they could play a hole.
Ah,
so let's say they're going to play hole number one. So they're going to hit a drive, and then they're going to go back and hit their 5 wood, and then they're going to hit their 9 iron onto the green. And like, so that's something more fun. So they can, you know, play a hole. That would be, or also try to hit balls with their eyes closed. That's always harder. But
yeah,
all
I'd
of
say.
Our kids in the academy learn how to play left-handed. So if they play right-handed, they have to play left-handed. So I've been doing that since 2012.
Wow. That is, you know, it's funny because sometimes just for fun, we had a long wait at a tournament I was at recently, and I was playing with a left-hander, and I just took his wedge and started chipping balls around the green left-handed, because I played left-handed in hockey like a lot of Canadians.
Sure.
And it is a different, you know, thing for your brain. Before we let you go, Tim, any final thoughts for TJ?
Well, I want to invite TJ to just give us a brief description of the golf tier system, because when I got home from vacation about a month ago, there's this big box waiting for me, and in it was about, I think, at least three board games and little boxes of flashcards. And it was just, I was just so impressed, TJ, about that. So could you just give us a brief description of the golf tier system? Because I think that for anyone who is looking to learn more about the rules and in a fun way, and particularly to help their kids along, I think it's brilliant. So can you explain the golf tier system?
Sure. So the first thing I did was I developed a program on how to rate a player without using a handicap. So that took me a good 3 months. And then from there, I divided that into 18 levels. And then from there, I divided it into 14 different chapters. So basically then the other ones are the board games. So I have three different board games. So one is like the Snakes and Ladders, which is, fun for kids. And then the other one is a line for golf, which is for adults. But the flashcards are always good for in the car. You know, instead of the kid having the phone, they could use the flashcards for the car.
Yeah, absolutely. So I think it's a wonderful thing for our listeners to check out. And a brilliant way, like as you said, a brilliant and fun way to learn the rules, because the overwhelming majority of golfers, and even, you know, like you just demonstrated a few minutes ago, don't know the rules. And knowing the rules can help you save face, if you will, in a tournament, avoid those awkward moments, but also give you some things to go on in your own game and when you might have to call somebody on something.
Exactly.
Yeah, exactly.
Anyways,
yeah.
I wanted to say congratulations to you for that, and also for being named the Western Section Junior Leader of the Year.
Thank you so much.
Well, that is amazing. And if people want to find out more about this kind of this work you've been doing for so long, such good work with young people in Canada, getting them scholarships, the website is zonegolfacademy.ca.
And my golf tier website is my.golftiersystem.com.
And Coach TJ, thanks for hanging out with us today.
Thank you.
I hope it wasn't
too
painful.
It's great to see you guys.
Oh, it's great to see you, Coach TJ. You're a very nice person. Everybody knows it.
Check out.
Thank you, my friend. Just let yourself
care.
Out.
Thank you.
And we'll continue on with this program. Bound, bound. See, there you go. There's somebody that knows what they're doing. I misunderstood when you showed me that book before we started. I love that. That's a, yeah, maybe you even said that was just like a mock-up, but it looks pretty cool, man.
Thanks. It is. But things that look cool, like that golf tier system. Oh my God. Yeah, golf tier system.
Yeah.
It is really, really impressive. And I said any golf nerd would love that stuff. So I encourage them to check it out. Yeah. So speaking of coming home from someplace, so I got home from Calgary, and on my doorstep was an Amazon package. And there it was, the very first bound edition of the book. So this is a... this is a proof copy, so I'm going through this and just catching like little thingies that we need to correct before we press go to make it live. But yeah, it was pretty damn cool to, after quite a long gestation.
Oh yeah, I'd say, yeah, that's a long pregnancy, my friend. It's a long pregnancy.
Well, yeah, well, I finished writing it in May and took all the way to now,
yes,
to finally get it in the book form. Yeah. So it's quite the process.
Anyone that's listened to any of the season 9 knows that it's been going on for some time. When are we going to announce the or is this for the public? The get together, the thing that you and I are doing.
Tuesday, October 1st at Blue Springs Golf Club. All right. If you live in the area, I invite you to come down 7 to 9 o'clock. Again, Tuesday, October 1st, we're going to have what they call a launch party. Me and my good friend GSL are going to be there, and we're going to talk about the book, how I got started on it, the long gestation, the birth.
The long and winding road. Yeah,
and, so it's available actually to the in public. The book, and how it might even help you.
Yeah.
And I'll sign some copies for it.
So
for
October 1st, that's available to the public, 7 to 9 at Blue Springs in the Milton area. I bring it up for a couple of reasons. I want people to come and meet you and I. But also, so you and I were going back and forth on just messaging back and forth about the dates.
Mm-hmm.
You were asking me if that date was available, and I'm like, yeah. And then I was on my way to play. I was doing a little coaching, I guess a playing lesson, but it was mostly a strategy coaching with a man that asked me to come and be his guest at the National. I'd met him. I met this person when they were playing with Ernie Els when I was hosting the Ben Kern. Started talking a little bit of strategy with them. They said, hey, I'd love to get into this more, decade stuff particularly. And he said, come, we'll play just you and I at the National. I'm like, okay, sure.
Well, I guess I could shoehorn it in.
Let me squeeze the National in my schedule. And this is the first time since I was a member that I've played this close together. Like, I usually play the National probably three times a year. I play the Invitational in June. There'll be one other time in the summer around the Kern. And then there's an event in November that I'm always invited to. It's a Champions Dinner. So that's pretty far apart. And so every time I go there, I'm super intimidated and I just play like shit. But this was like within a week and a half of playing it recently, I got to play it again and I was playing okay. But the reason I'm bringing it up is I sent you a note. Now, in my mind, I thought in our exchange for some reason that I had told you I was playing the National. So I send this note to Tim. Played pretty nicely today. 5 bogeys and 4 pars per 9 for 81. Made 4 bogeys from the middle of the fairway with 8 iron or less in my hand. Again, thinking that you knew I was playing there. Tim's response, and it took me a few days to sort of figure it out. He goes, don't think I've ever got a message like that from you. You have definitely ascended. And now, so you can see the broken telephone happening here, he thinks I'm just telling him about a random round where I shot 81 and didn't want to punch myself in the face, which I'm able to do, by the way. I mean, I've had lots of rounds this year that were, not my average round and was fine. But your response was so sweet and kind. I was like, What is he talking about? And then this morning before we started, I said, by the way, that message I sent you, did you not know I was playing the National? And you were like, no. So 81 there is like par.
I thought it was like a cash round at the at Glen Cairn with some guys. And, oh, I shot 81, and you know, I'm okay with it. And
I, no, I know. And I was like, what?
That's why I was kind of like, why is he telling me about a round at 81? Well, I guess we could just be nice and affirming.
Yeah,
and you all were. That good stuff to my pal Howard.
And meanwhile, you know? You're like, what the fuck is this all about?
Well, you know what? To me, just before I can't let this go.
No, keep me going.
Well, this is yet more proof that text and email
yes.
are among the worst communication mediums ever invented.
Well, you need tone and context. They sometimes they don't have context or tone. And in this particular case, I just left out an important...
No context.
Yeah. Yeah, two things happened that day that... So when I play it in tournament form, it's always really fast. And I was out with my friend Grant there. It was really fast. At the Ben Curran, it was 12-7 to 13, which is like major championship speed. And in the Ben Curran round, I three-putted six times.
Yeah, which is... But just how was the,
couldn't stop putting.
What about the Willie Park? Weston is renowned for slopey, fast greens that they speed up in the Willie Park. So how was that?
Have we not spoken since my Willie Park demise?
Aww.
Okay, but let me just finish the National first.
I'm listening.
So I go to the National, and they're back to normal everyday speeds, which are about 11-2. So pretty fast for an average
Still
golfer.
Still fast.
And so two things that day. I hit the ball really, really well. And when I say I made four bogeys, I made three of those four bogeys with wedge in my hand. I had an 8-iron into one green from like 145, but the rest of the time I made bogey from the middle of the fairway because I just didn't quite compress it enough. The ball hit the green and then went over the green or went short of the green or went left of the pin, and I couldn't get the ball up and down. So I hit it pretty well. 81 was a good score. So I played the Willie Park, which is a traditional, long-standing tournament around here. They've been doing it forever.
Oh, it's renowned. It's a renowned event.
At Weston. And Weston's very, very fast greens. And Ashley Chinner, who's played in a couple Canadian Opens, played on the PGA Tour. So now we're all playing it. I usually used to play it as a kid. The guys play 36 holes. But now the senior guys play 18. And Ashley won it, shooting 71.
Oh, good for him.
Yeah, really good game. With two holes to go, I was two over par, and I found out later that that would have put me in second place.
Should we put some mournful music on below this or anything? I was thinking something more symphonic, but that'll do.
So, and I hit 14 greens in regulation that day, but already at this point in the round, I'm two over par, but I've made a bunch of birdies, and I've three putted a couple of times, which is pretty about average for the day. Mm-hmm. And my 17th hole is the 8th hole at Weston, which is 135-yard par 3 that has Ooh. Such severe slope from right to left, that and the pin was in the left. You have to hit your ball. I had a wedge in my hand, or a 9-iron. You have to hit your ball 40 or 50 feet right of the flag, because the whole thing will just, it's like a teacup. It will pour it down toward yeah. the hole. Well, I hit this perfect shot. You could see it hit the slope and it went down to the left. And I couldn't see where it was, but it was going to be close to the flag. And sure enough, we drive up there and my ball's 2.5 feet from the hole. So here's a great takeaway for you swing thought nerds. As I'm driving up there, I'm thinking, okay, I'm two over. I'm going to make a birdie here. I'm going to be one over. Then I'm going to par 18. 73, that's going to be close to winning this thing. This is what I thought. I know.
Yep. Well, it's natural. You're a human.
Yeah.
Okay. I know. Go ahead.
I mean, no, I was going to say, I know that. Like,
well,
that,
actually, I know your GSL, but.
But that thought came into my head, word for word. This is what I thought. And my thought after that was, and this is where it gets ugly, is it's too Sorry, bad. Laughing, so. It's too bad that putt isn't below the hole because.
Oh.
I was 2.5 feet above the hole. So I'm the last to putt, obviously. And funny, because Ashley was just ahead of us. And as he was walking by, he kind of gave me the thumbs up. Like, nice shot. Actually, what he did first, he pointed his, that you? I went, yeah, that's me. He goes, great putt, great shot. And then we're sitting there having dinner after. And he's like, what the fuck happened? I said, well, it was pretty chaotic. Now, what I'm about to tell you.
You're messing with the timeline here.
But what I'm about to tell you is a, you'd think after all the years I've played tournament golf, I would know better. So I'm already a little bit nervous. Something in my body tells me this putt is difficult, and it was. Mm-hmm. Because it's 2.5 feet or so, and I have to hit the ball outside the hole, but with enough speed on it. Like, it's not a straight putt. With enough speed on it to keep its line, like, I can't just wave it in there. I can't just, like, baby it in there. So I hit it. It hard lips out, and it goes down a slope 6 feet away. And here's where I couldn't believe what I did. I went, I'll finish. What? What? You'll finish what? Like, I said I'll finish like it was a foot below the hole. I didn't even mark my ball again. I just was so rattled that it happened that I went, I'll finish. And then later I was like, you'll finish? What were you thinking? Like, it was every rule I've ever told anybody, take your full turn. Like, mark it, line it up again, give it a shot. Because now it's a fairly straightforward putt because it's right up the hill. So I say, I'll finish. Even the guys I'm playing with were like, what are you doing? Because I was last. I'm all done. Everyone's done. So I miss that putt. It lips out. And now, to make matters even worse, I go to tap it in like a dickhead and miss that putt.
How far was the tap in? Like 18 inches kind of thing?
Something. I didn't even, the one footer. I did the 1 foot like lean in and 1 foot putt it. And I missed that putt. So if you're keeping track at home, kids, Grandpa four putted.
Oh.
So now my dreams of winning, I go from 2 over to 4 over. And then I hit a really good drive on 8 or 9. There, my 18th hole. Hit a really good second shot, but I'm 35 feet uphill putt. But now I'm so afraid of going by the hole that I leave it like 7 feet short, 8 feet short, and miss that putt, 3 putt. So I go 4 putt, 3 putt, and shoot 77. And I go from finishing second, because if I had just gone par par, I finished second. Forget birdieing the thing. And I finished 6th. So, like, a decent showing.
You know, went to dinner? Did you go to dinner?
Absolutely. And I sat around with everybody, you know, and again, I'm sitting next to Ashley. I'm sitting next to Ashley, and he says, that was a great shot. He said, what happened? Because he saw that I had a double bogey. So I thought you were just tapping. I thought you were just going to tap it in. I go, dude, I tried to, but then it went a long way away, and he laughed. But that just goes to show you that even at this stage of ascension, the biggest mistake I made, forget that I thought of all those things, because you're going to think that, hey, I'm playing great. I had just birdied, by the way. I just birdied 16. So I was thinking birdie, birdie, finish, you know, whatever, birdie, And but I had a sense of doom when I saw where that putt was. And maybe the mistake also was trying to make it. If I had just tried to, like, I know it sounds absurd, to just try and cozy it up and maybe make it, I would have made par. And as we all know from algebra, that 3 is better than 5. So I had a nice showing. And again, when somebody asks you, how'd you do at the Willie Park? I go, I finished 6th. They go, great. And I go, yeah, it wasn't so great. But because as we both know, and I appreciate your listening and you at home, no one gives a shit about your story. I mean, I have this forum here to share it with everybody. And I think I share it because I want you to know your stories are exactly like mine, you know? So somebody asked me, I was at a tournament 2 days ago, and someone said, hey, I saw you at the Willie. How'd you finish? I said, 6th. They went, okay, good showing. I went, thumbs up. Yep. See ya. That's all.
Yeah, you don't need to go into the story. Yeah.
For details, listen to my podcast.
Film 11.
Oh,
boy. Well, I'm glad that you're sitting here telling us in a joyous way with a smile on your face and that your car suffered no damage. After this, you went to dinner. All good stuff. All signs that you have ascended. Yes, sir. But boy, oh boy, I relate so much to what you're saying. Reminds me. So shameless plug for a book, a 4-putt. In my club championship figures very prominently at the beginning of this book, but it's the awareness of what's happening and the ability to just maybe step back from it. And man, it's so effing hard to do that, to extract yourself kind of from the situation and look at it kind of from this big perspective. Again, I remember we talked about a few weeks ago about a situation you had, this really difficult shot. I think it was at Hamilton. The ball was sitting
down in a pile of hay.
If you had a caddy or someone else to provide some perspective. So I guess the point I'm getting to is that sometimes it sounds very weird. It's almost like you have to step outside of yourself to go, what's happening here? Observing yourself with this just detachment. And I think that's what players like Jack Nicklaus and Tiger Woods were able to do. Regardless of what was happening, the stakes, the so-called pressure, they were able to just be aware of what was going on. You did have the choice of given the fact that as soon as you told me that it was 2.5 feet above the hole, you foreshadowed what was going to happen.
Yeah, of course.
Everyone can just see that happening.
You make a great point. And the thing that, like, I wasn't, yeah, it's disappointing. And disappointing for a lot of reasons, not the least of which I really had it on full roast that day. I hit it.
Totally.
One of the guys I played with is the organizer of the tournament. He's been a member there for years and years, and I've known him for 12 years. Very good player. He's playing in the Canadian Senior this week. His name is John Ward, and very, very fine player. And he said to me, he's one of the people I know that calls me Howie. He said, Howie, I have played a lot of golf with him, tournament golf. I played in the senior amateur with him a couple of times. He said, Howie, I played a lot of golf with you, but today was one of the best ball striking rounds I've ever seen. And, commiserating with me, you deserve better than that score. But what I was disappointed in myself in the time that ball went 6 feet down the slope that I didn't. If you had been there or I had been caddying for you, I would have said, hang on a second. Let's mark the ball. Let's take a second because three's not two, but it's better than what's about to happen. But the thing, when I said I'll finish, like something in my brain was like screaming at me. But what it was I was embarrassed.
Totally. Let's get off stage.
I was embarrassed and a little bit red-faced by what just happened.
Totally.
And I wanted it, just like everyone else, I wanted it to be over quick. And then when I four-putted, like, everyone in the group felt bad for me. But, we've all done it.
Absolutely.
I played an event 2 days ago. I qualified a qualifier. And the other guys in our group had a couple of putts, soft lip outs. The ones where the balls looks like it's going in and then it just kind of softly melts past the hole. And my response is always, man, how hard does this game have to be?
Oh, I know. And that's the point I wanted to make is that there you are. You said you were on full roast. Like for 4.5 hours, you're playing great golf. And this is what makes this fucking game so, so hard is that you can play so well and then just a couple of putts in a matter of 30 seconds. It's like the whole thing goes up in flames, but it doesn't really because you can take that learning will take you forward.
But your head feels like everything's gone up in flames. Think about how weird this game is. 138 yard par three. I took more strokes on it than the 520 yard par five before it, where I made four.
Oh, exactly.
Think of Rory McIlroy. It's absurd.
Yeah, think of Rory McIlroy in the U.S. Open.
Yeah.
I mean, he, for 4 days, major championship pressure, all this, the stories, will Rory win his first in years and years, et cetera. Two bad putts, and he doesn't win. So, yeah. I mean, it's such a hard game to maintain that perspective and that sense of detachment that you need when these things happen, because they are going to happen. The worst I ever saw, I know I've told this story before, but I think it's apropos in terms of a learning moment, was the National Golf Championship I forget when it was, pre-COVID. UBC men's team, Western's men's team, they're tied as a team, the team score. So they send out five twosomes out to play for the championship in a playoff. And I think it was the second group through. Kid from Western has maybe about a 20-foot birdie putt. He rolls it up there to about 16, 18 inches and just, you know, tap in for a nice par. And he just walks up and he takes his stance and I go, oh my God, that's way too casual. Mm-hmm. I said to the kid beside me, and he missed. And of course, the kid is just crestfallen. He feels like he just cost his team a national championship because he missed an 18-inch putt, but he just, again, he just didn't take his time. And it was similar to your experience, I think. It's like, let's get off stage. Let's get this done. Let's get this over with. And, oh, man.
Yeah, and that's why I say, like, I never got mad. I have conquered the getting mad part. I really have. Not just this year. Years of
disappointed big time.
Well, I definitely was. But, I mean, it's years of practicing neutrality has kind of given me this. I feel like I walked to the next tee and I killed my drive on. It was the ninth hole at Westin, which is, again, long par four for guys our age, 4th, 10, whatever it was. And, you know, I hit two very nice shots. But I'm not immune to the. I still had this, like I said, I had a little bit of a PTSD from just four putting. And, you know,
you're GSL, but you're still.
Yeah. But I was the thing that I want people to take away is that feeling, that red face flushed feeling of sort of humiliation. I mean, that gives you the golf. There's so much emotional connection to and you're better at this than I am about what our stories are and our self belief in our, you know, what we think of ourselves really comes out in how we perform. And so guys like me and you know, my partner on, I had a qualifier with Charlie Fitzsimmons, our buddy Dr. Fitz, and I, like, all I have is I'm just more experienced. You know, I've between Westin and, which was Friday, the Labor Day, I've played 4 or 5 events since then. Like, I've played a bunch of tournament golf. So, yeah, I get a little nervous and, you know, but what I was disappointed about my behavior on that green was I know better, but even knowing better, I'm not immune to that feeling of, I love what you said, I've got to get this over with and off stage. Something has gone wrong. And you know, again, I wish I would have been a better caddy for myself, or if I'd had a caddy, the worst I would have made 4, which is better than 5 also.
Yeah, exactly. So so much of why this game of golf is so difficult is that it's not what we know that causes our issues. It's what we do. And it's these patterns of behavior that we're not even conscious of. Stuff happens and out of your mouth comes, I'll finish. And suddenly you're doing something that you probably, even in a part of you, maybe even knew it was wrong to do it. But it's like, I remember John Bradshaw, this family therapist who's on.
I know who PBS. He is.
He goes, he says, I know I'm screwing it up and I don't care.
Yeah.
But you do it anyways because your system, your belief system, your patterns of behavior say, danger, get out of here, get this over with. Yes. And so you just fall into this pattern of behavior. Whereas if you had someone else with you, they would have said, stop, mark it, breathe, look around, look at me.
Mm-hmm.
Something just to get yourself centered and grounded and just let it go. Because part of the thing that happens, I've watched it happen, it's happened to me, is that it's kind of like time starts to speed up and you're just kind of in this vortex that of experience, you don't even really know what's happening. And you're just so disconnected from your body and really from disconnected from reality of what's going on. Because your system is on full alert, alarm, get out of here. And just, you just can't operate. It becomes an access issue. You can't access your talent, skill, and experience where you're in that place of alarm.
You know, if you had seen my, and I can see it clearly now, and what you said is very apt. I was, when I say, you know, humiliation is just feeling shame. Mm-hmm. And I felt what gives you that flushed feeling. My head, I don't even remember seeing the other two guys in my group when I said, I'll finish.
Yep.
I wasn't looking up. I was sort of, my head was down because that thing that just happened, I felt was shameful that I missed a 2.5 foot putt.
And that's an internal experience. Just absolutely. Be real quick. So those guys aren't thinking, well, that fucking idiot. They're not thinking that. They're thinking, oh, poor bastard.
Poor guy. That was a tough putt. That's what they were thinking.
Exactly. That was really hard. That could happen to me.
Yeah.
But that was all your own experience. And you know what? You're just, you're a better man for having experienced it and move on. You laugh about it later. That's why, you know, what's the, you would know this one. What's the equation for comedy? Pain plus time.
Yeah. Tragedy plus comedy. Time. Yeah.
Yeah.
So quickly, Charlie, I played in a member event on the weekends, two rounds, four matches. And I just wanted to quickly tell you about, it's sort of related, what pressure does to regular people that don't play tournaments. So there was me and my partner, after four rounds of nine holes, got to the finals of our division. So we won our section. It's very complicated. There's like a whole bunch of groups, but in our section, there were seven groups in a playoff, and I'm talking 100 people watching it. And it was an alternate shot playoff. And my part, so there's seven of us. Two people shit the bed immediately, but five of us on a short par five at Glencairn hit the fairway, and my partner was, I let him tee off. He hits the ball very nicely off the tee, and I'm just more confident overall, but I wanted him to get that out of the way so he's not confident with his irons from the fairway. Here's how short a par five it was. I had the first ball into the green, and I was 178 or so, less than 180 on a short par five, and it was howling wind, and I hit a seven iron.
Like downwind.
Downwind. And the other four people that had a chance to hit the green were ahead of me, and they were younger. So out of five potential people hitting the green, how many people hit the green? Well, I'll give you the answer. It was one.
Exactly. You.
Me. Now, I'm not because I'm so fucking good. It's because I wasn't affected by it. I had just played the Willie Park. I had just been I've had enough of it. I'm over the ball going, yeah, I think part of it is too. I like the attention, as you know. I like people watching me. I think it's cool. I'm almost like, I was so happy to go first because if I knew one thing, if I go first, it's going to be harder for those guys to hit the green because I'm going to hit the green. I have seven iron in my fucking hand.
It's like advantage.
Totally.
You have the advantage.
Now, one other group, they were young guys. So they had like nine iron or wedge. So they hit the back of the green onto the fringe. So they were putting. But the other people, Tim, when I tell you it was like chaos, fucking balls were flying everywhere because it's hard to pull the trigger.
Yeah.
And that's the moral of the story is just we all, like I've seen this over my career, we all feel those feelings. And when it happens to you, just know that everybody does. I was in a shootout at our club. We do these things for men's night where you get closest to the pin. So there's all the closest to the pin winners gather once a month. So we're at 125 yards. Out of 10 or 12 guys, three guys hit the green. I wasn't one of them. I just pushed it a little bit. So the takeaway is that it's hard for all of us, whether it's me or Charlie or you or guys that aren't experienced. We all have this feeling of like not wanting to be ashamed of what we're doing. But as you quite rightly pointed out, no one else gives a shit. They don't care.
No one cares. NOC.
They don't care. You know, and I tell you, I played this round on Monday with Charlie. Both of us played great at times. But when I tell you that Charlie Fitzsimmons, who's qualified, by the way, for the U.S. Mid-Am, is playing in the U.S. Mid-Am. He's a high, high level player. Well, there were a couple holes there, the back nine mainly, where I said to him after four or five holes where he had taken a bit of a vacation, I said, you're getting fucking heavy here, kid. I need a little, give grandpa a bit of help. I will tell you this, you know, when he's on, it's something to see. You know, we had made a couple bogeys. This is better ball. We made a couple bogeys in the front nine, and I was lucky. I birdied the eighth hole to get our team back to even par, and then Charlie just went ahead and birdied the next three in a row, just like. And then after his third birdie, I went, oh, yeah, you're Charlie Fitzsimmons. I remember you. He laughed. I go, now I know who you are. You're Charlie Fitzsimmons. Yeah, I've heard of you.
Hey, okay. How did the alternate shot final playoff, how did that turn out?
Out of seven teams, Four of us got birdies. And then we had a playoff where you had to putt closest to the hole.
Wow.
But you weren't allowed to watch, and I was the last one to go. It's about a 40-foot putt, not easy. And so three teams went on. But what they did is they put, because of my handicap, we had to play the back tees. So I teed off, hit a really good tee shot, you know, on a pretty long par four, 420. My partner had like 180 into the green, whatever it was. And the two young guys, when I say young, like early 30s, they got to go off the blues. And I'll tell you how far this one kid hit it. They had like 90 yards into the green. He just hit this great drive. My partner had like, you know, a hybrid or some shit into the wind. So they made birdie and we were done. But it was fun. It was a fun experience, you know. And Charlie and I qualified once again.
Congratulations.
The tradition continues for the Ontario Better Ball. This is like 7 years in a row that we got in, and it'll be fun.
Yeah, Kent told me it didn't go so swell.
With him and I? Oh, no, we just shit the bed. Oh, my God, it was awful. There's how crazy golf is. On a Wednesday and men's night, I shoot 74 on my home course. On Friday, I come in sixth at the Willie Park. On Thursday, in between, Kent and I go to qualify. Like, at a golf course, it's not that hard. He and I both would have shot... Neither of us would have broken 80 that day, and he's a very, very good golfer. We just were...
Yes.
It was just awful. And then he played with you the next day, and he probably shot even par.
Yeah, exactly. He couldn't miss. He was just like, you know, right on fire. And like, I didn't even know what he shot, but I'm sure it was close to even par.
Yeah, he told me you hit some good shots, too. He was very impressed with the way you hit the ball, and I'm like, yeah, man, that's fucking Tim O'Connor.
Well, it was a fun, fun day. I haven't played National Pines in... maybe a decade, and wow, there's some roller coaster greens there. Holy cow.
Yeah, it's a
great
golf course. Well, let's review October 1st at Blue Springs. We all want you to, you're all invited. Is there any way that they need to register? Can they just show up?
You can just show up, but if you feel like sending me an email to tim@oconnorgolf.ca, that would be swell. I'm going to be sending out a general invite to my Substack, toconnor.substack.com, and yeah, it'll be all over my stuff, so all Facebook right. and all that good stuff.
And this is this is not a formal affair. I'm thinking you want me to wear long pants, though, right? Am I going to
be sitting on those? We're going to be doing like that. I don't know. It's not going to be like point counterpoint.
Like Q&A.
We'll be on stools. We'll be sitting there, you know, looking very cash.
Yeah.
Yeah.
All right. Well, maybe we wear Oscar Bravo finery. But just make sure don't wear the same one.
We'll coordinate our Oscar Bravo.
All right, it's a trousers, a long pants event.
Well, what do they say at a private golf course like Blue Springs? Something casual.
Business casual?
Golf casual. People know how to dress to go to golf.
Come on. And we'd love to see
just
you
don't
there.
Wear your cutoff denim shorts a tank top.
That's right. Don't come dressed like Rob Schneider from every Adam Sandler movie. Okay, Tim O'Connor, thanks to TJ Attlee, Golf Zone Academy. Thanks to TaylorMade Golf, who is OscarBravo.com, and SecretLinks.golf. And as always, this program is produced by Humble and Fred Radio, and you can get a hold of us at humbleandfredradio.com. Tim, congratulations. Looking forward to seeing you in a couple weeks, and all the best, everyone. Well, now you step inside, but you don't see too many faces.